following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Oh, boy. Welcome to a Wednesday, and it is a busy, busy day at that, as if you'd expect anything else these days in America. Welcome to it. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the East Coast at NicoleSandler.com. Throughout the day on a number of different progressive online stations, and of course, we end the day on the Progressive Voices Network, Tuesday through Friday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern. Today happens to be a really, really busy day. Aside from having two guests scheduled to join us to go over stuff that's happening right now, Alexander Acosta, the Secretary of Labor, is wrapping up his press conference, in which
obviously have.
I'm not even gonna play it for you. He lied. He lies with impunity. He's taking cues from his boss. Because it's still going on, I was actually playing the audio as I was getting ready to hit the air at 3 o'clock Eastern. So I didn't have a chance to pull any clips from it. But I got to hand it to Maggie Haberman, Katie Rogers, and Peter Baker over at the New York Times, because even though the thing is still going on, they already published a story at the NewYorkTimes.com. And no, unfortunately, he's not stepping down. Here's how their story begins. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta on Wednesday publicly defended his role in overseeing the prosecution of Jeffrey Epstein for sex crimes committed in Florida over a decade ago, bucking a growing chorus of Democratic calls for his resignation. Mr. Acosta said he faced a tough choice between accepting a plea deal that was not as tough as he wished it would be and going to trial with witnesses who were scared to testify in what he calls a roll, in what he described as a roll of the dice that might not result in a conviction and prison term. Quote, I wanted to help them, Mr. Acosta said of the victims during a nationally televised news conference at the Labor Department headquarters. Quote, that is why we intervened, and that's what the prosecutors of my office did. They insisted that he go to jail and put the world on notice that he was and is a sexual predator. Hey, Acosta, you know what I have to say to you? Oh, I turned it down.
Bullshit.
Yes. Yes, and I got my wallow sound working again. Only took me a few hours yesterday. Anyway, so this is still going on. He is doubling down, and it's just reprehensible. A few other things. He went through probably 10 questions from male reporters before he called on a female. Then when a second female tried to ask a question, he cut her off and said, no, I wanted to go to Ian first. I'll come back to you. I don't know if he came back to her. Unbelievable. So it's still going on. All right. There's other stuff happening today, too. Let me tell you about some of the other stuff. And let me start by saying yesterday when Got a Laugh was here, I was trying to relay to her something I had read earlier, and I couldn't find it anywhere. Well, she found it today, and it was a tweet from Heather Cagle of Politico who said, Speaker Pelosi essentially rules out the House impeaching or investigating Secretary Acosta, quote, it's up to the president. It's his cabinet. We have a great deal of work to do here for the good of the American people, and we have to focus on that. My memory was pretty good yesterday, which is shocking to me because, you know, long-term loss of short-term memory. But anyway, I did remember the quote fairly closely, and she's doubling down on it today. This from Politico this morning. Speaker Nancy Pelosi chided progressives in a closed-door meeting this morning, calling on them to address their intra-party grievances privately rather than blaming their centrist colleagues on Twitter. Quote, so again, you got a complaint? You come and talk to me about it, Nancy Pelosi told Democrats, according to a source in the room. But do not tweet about our members and expect us to think that it is just okay. End quote. Pelosi's comments came during the first full caucus meeting since a major blow-up over emergency border funding last month between progressives and moderate lawmakers, as well as a recent spat with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her freshman allies. I gotta tell you, Nancy Pelosi needs to go home. Enough already. In other news from today, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed a lawsuit filed by Maryland and D.C., alleging that Donald Trump is violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, finding that they did not have the standing to sue the president. The ruling, obviously, is a major win for Trump, who has frequently sought to prevent others from reviewing his private financial records. I'm not sure what happens next, but you can bet I will ask our first guest. And we've still got a couple of minutes before I can call him. We're going to speak with Ian Millhiser of Think Progress. You know I'm not a big Think Progress fan, but I do like Ian Millhiser, and I think he's really good at what he does. In addition to being a columnist for Think Progress, he's got a book out. His most recent book is called Injustices, and it's about the Supreme Court. So not only do I want to ask him about what happened this morning with this emoluments case, and to find out what happens next. In other words, Are we able to, Congress obviously has standing. Are they going to do anything? This isn't just a dead deal for Trump now, is it? Because he is guilty of violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. So this panel, this three-judge panel, two of them were Bush appointees and one a Trump appointee. Isn't that wonderful how that works? Ruled against us, ruled in favor of Trump. But I know that that can't be the end of it. So we'll ask Ian Millhiser about that, as well as, well, the other reason that I have him coming on, which is the citizenship question. There's a bunch of stuff we want to talk to him about. So we'll get Ian Millhiser on the line in just a couple of minutes. Like I said, we still have a minute before I can call him. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's urgent. Oh, Britain's ambassador to the U.S., Kim Darroch, has resigned after a series of leaked diplomatic cables revealed he told the prime minister that the Trump administration was inept and clumsy. They are. This comes after, of course, Trump said Monday that the White House would no longer deal with the British ambassador. Go figure. So there's other news going on. Again, we're going to talk. Congress already has already filed suit. Okay, good. Thank you. Anyway, you know what? Let's get Ian Millhiser on the line, shall we? Because there's obviously a lot to talk to him about. Ian Millhiser is, as I mentioned, he is the a columnist at Think Progress and the author of the book Injustices. Ian Millhiser, thank you so much for joining us today. It's Nicole Sandler calling. I'm guessing
good to be here.
It's great to have you here, and we're going to get to what happened yesterday in a courtroom dealing with the Affordable Care Act. But I've got to ask: I'm sure you had to have been like the rest of us, and for the last half hour or so, watching Alexandra Acosta do a press conference on the Epstein case. Did you watch it?
I mean, I haven't been able to see much of it, but I mean, I know enough of the facts of the case to know that this man has no business being in government anymore. I mean, this is the guy who was responsible for the broad immunity plea.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, frankly, I think the only reason he has his job is because the Trump administration is so bad at personnel that they know that if they fire him, you know, I mean, the last time they tried to find a secretary of labor, the first guy they picked was a wife beater. So
yep.
I think that, you know, they don't want to have to do that again. But, you know, in any sane administration, this person would have been gone a long time ago.
Without a doubt. But apparently he was trying to, you know, cover his ass. That's the technical term for what this presser was about. And was given ample opportunity by the reporters in the room to apologize to his victims for keeping them in the dark about everything. And in his response, he does not apologize to the victims, in case you were wondering. It's just a travesty what's going on. Yeah. But the main reason I wanted to speak with you today, Ian Millhiser, and thank you so much for joining us, is you were in the room yesterday during the hearing, the latest hearing on the Trump administration's efforts to overturn and totally disembowel, I guess, the Affordable Care Act. Most of us believed that this was already over, that this was settled law in essence, but the Trump administration is still doing this. There's a lawsuit that they filed to declare that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. Is that what this is about?
Yeah, this is nuts, is what this is. Uh-huh. So the legal theory here is, you'll recall that the original Affordable Care Act said that you have to either have health insurance or you have to pay higher taxes. And the Supreme Court, you'll probably remember, upheld that as a valid exercise of Congress's power to tax. In 2017, the Republican Congress zeroed out that tax. So they said that, yes, like you still have to carry health insurance or pay a tax, but the amount of the tax is $0.
Okay.
And the argument here is, because the tax is now $0, it's no longer a tax, which means it's unconstitutional. And also, the appropriate remedy, if this tax that does nothing is unconstitutional, is to throw out the entirety of the Affordable Care Act. So it is a bonkers legal theory. Frankly, the attorneys who brought it should have been sanctioned for bringing frivolous litigation. And instead, it wound up in front of two extraordinarily partisan Republican judges, and they look likely to sign on to this goat rodeo.
Wow. Now, this is the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans?
Yeah. So this is the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which is one step below the Supreme Court. Ooh. The Fifth Circuit is absolutely stacked with Trumpy judges. And so part of the problem here is you're dealing with one of the worst courts in the country. The panel included Kurt Engelhardt, who's a Trump judge, and this woman named Jennifer Elrod, who is a Bush judge, who's known for very right-wing opinions, limiting voting rights, limiting abortion rights, ruling against immigrants. So this was a very, very bad panel. There's a third judge, Judge King, who's a Carter appointee. Hmm. I'm sure she'll be fine.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, this is a very bad panel. It was Elrod, who's a very right-wing Bush appointee, and Engelhardt, who's a Trump judge. And, you know, maybe, I mean, the legal arguments in this case are so embarrassing that maybe they'll realize that, like, they don't want to be remembered by posterity for doing this. But I wouldn't bet on it based on what I saw in the courtroom. They looked determined to gut the Affordable Care Act.
Right. And that was what you tweeted upon leaving the hearing yesterday, is that it was not a good day. It looks like they are going to do this. Obviously, yeah. This is the fifth. This is, you said, a step below the Supreme Court. I'm guessing right. It would automatically be appealed to the Supreme Court. And didn't the Supreme Court already weigh in on the Affordable Care Act?
They have. I mean, this is kind of a new legal theory. You know, again, the legal theory here is that by repealing one provision of the Affordable Care Act, Congress somehow required the courts to take out the entire Affordable Care Act. And that's, you feel gaslit just hearing someone make the argument.
Mm-hmm.
It's an insane argument. But yeah, if the Fifth Circuit strikes this down, the Supreme Court will certainly hear the case eventually. Now, one thing that I think is really troubling is that there's a lot of talk at yesterday's argument about ways to delay the case, ways to prevent anyone from appealing it right away.
Huh.
There was talk about sending it down to the trial court again so he could do some unnecessary proceedings. And it's frightening because I don't know why the judges would think about doing that. But one possible reason is they might be thinking that, well, you know, the longer we run out the clock on this, the more likely it is that someone else leaves the Supreme Court and maybe Donald Trump gets to replace them.
Oh, God.
And right now, I'm fairly confident that if Chief Justice Roberts is the median vote on the Supreme Court, that Roberts is going to look at this and say, are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
But the other four Republicans have already shown themselves to be hyperpartisan. We saw that in the census case.
Yep.
Where they said that essentially the Trump administration is allowed to lie. You know, it's allowed to put a policy in place and then lie about why they're doing it. And so I think there's probably four votes right now to get rid of the Affordable Care Act by any means necessary. And if another Democrat were to leave the court, then that would mean that there would be five.
Oh, my God. We are so screwed. And here's the thing. I mean, it's unconscionable because the Republicans, despite what Trump says, we know he lies with every breath he takes. There is no Republican health care plan. If the Affordable Care Act goes away, and make no mistake, it is an imperfect plan. But at least, well, because of it, I'm still alive. Because 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with lung cancer, and the only reason I had health insurance was because of the Affordable Care Act. So I guess people, I'm going to be out of luck again because coverage for pre-existing conditions will go away immediately, along with, you know, access for millions and millions of people to health insurance.
Yeah. So let's put some numbers on that.
Okay.
If the Affordable Care Act is repealed by the courts, 20 million people lose their health insurance, and they could lose it overnight.
Wow.
So 20 million people lose their health insurance. The best estimate I've seen is if 20 million people lose their health insurance, that means 24,000 additional deaths every year from people who are unable to obtain health care. 24,000 people who otherwise would have lived will die year after year after year.
Yep.
If the courts do what Trump and what a bunch of Republican attorney generals are asking them to do here. Now, if an invading army did that, if the Russians invaded the United States and killed, slaughtered 24,000 people and then did it year and year and year again, we would call that an atrocity.
Right.
That's the sort of thing that the UN Security Council gets involved in. That's the sort of thing you send peacekeepers to deal with. But in this case, it's not an army. It's two judges who think they have the right to do that, despite no legal basis for doing so. And, you know, I just hope that people understand the moral stakes here. Because what these judges are contemplating isn't just wrong, and it isn't just wrong as a matter of law. It would be one of the most significant acts of mass killing on U.S. soil since the Civil War.
Wow. That's an important way to look at it. And I hope that, Capitol Hill looks at it that way as well. Ian Millhiser is with us. He's a columnist at Think Progress. He's the author of the book Injustices, Dealing with the Supreme Court. And this, you know, you mentioned the possibility that Trump gets to replace another Supreme Court justice, in which case I think this little experiment in democracy is just about done. And I wonder, you know, how much his stacking of the courts has already had such a big impact. This morning, or was it last night, there was a ruling, a D.C. court, I believe, found that the Washington, D.C. and Maryland, who filed in a case, a emoluments charge against Donald Trump, that case was thrown out because the judge said that Maryland and D.C. didn't have standing to bring that case to court. I'm guessing Congress has standing. Are they doing anything about this, or is the emoluments deal over?
So there are a number of plaintiffs who I think would have standing. So I think the best plaintiff would be the Ritz-Carlton. And the reason for that, so standing is in order to bring a lawsuit, you have to be able to show that you are injured in some way by the law you're challenging. That, by the way, is why another reason why the Fifth Circuit should not do what it's considering with Obamacare, because the law that they're challenging is the zeroed out mandate, and you can't be injured by a law that requires you to pay $0.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, so standing is the requirement that you have to be injured by whatever it is that you're challenging. And the reason why the Ritz-Carlton has a good argument that they were injured by Trump's violations of the Emoluments Clause is, as I recall, shortly after Trump was elected, the Kuwaiti embassy intended to they had a party that they were going to throw at the Ritz-Carlton, and they decided to move it to the Trump Hotel. So here is a case where you have a party that could show, like, we were going to get this money from this customer, and we lost the customer specifically because of a federal official violating the Emoluments Clause. Now, that might be a little harder because I believe that that happened when Trump was president-elect, so that you'd have to fight over whether the president-elect counts as an officer of the United States. The other body that I think definitely has standing is the United States itself.
Right.
And so even though the Trump administration, like Trump's Justice Department, isn't going to sue Donald Trump for violating the Emoluments Clause, but when Trump leaves office, he's still going to have all these ill-gotten gains from his constitutional violations.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the Emoluments Clause there to protect? It's there to protect the United States itself from corrupt officials. So who was injured by a corrupt official violating the Constitution of the United States? The United States is injured by it. And so in the next presidency, I think that the Justice Department should file a suit against Donald Trump, at the very least, to recoup the ill-gotten gains he got through his emoluments violations.
Wow. So while he's in office, though, there's nothing we can do about him thumbing his nose at the rule of law. I mean, everything from the Hyde Amendment to the Emoluments Clause, he just doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, I mean, while he is in office, I think that the remedies that are available are more limited. Now, that said, the remedy that is available if you catch him violating the Emoluments Clause is going to be limited anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What you could probably get is you can get him, you would have to refund the money that he got in violation of the Emoluments Clause. At most, you might be able to get an injunction requiring him to divest from certain businesses or to just stop doing businesses with foreign governments entirely. But what you couldn't get is you couldn't get an order that removed him from office.
Right.
So the bad news is that he's going to be president for his term. And you know, the courts can't do anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that when he leaves office, the United States would have standing to sue him for his violations of the Emoluments Clause.
Well, I hate that we have to wait till he leaves office, because frankly, I don't think he's going to leave office without a real fight. That's just me, but it's a fear that I don't believe is without grounds. Ian Millhiser, let me ask you one last question. That is the way Nancy Pelosi is handling things. I hate to quote Michael Avenatti of all people, but I read something on Twitter that he wrote, and I have to agree with him. He said, "If Acosta does not resign, look out, because the Dem leadership is ready to tweet and send letters at a moment's notice." Yup, no fear. Tweets and letters. Trump and the R's have figured out they can do whatever they want because the Dems have no guts and don't know how to work the media. I hate to say it, I agree.
So I guess what my response to that is that House Democrats should use every power at their disposal to try to get Alex Acosta out of office and to try to get Donald Trump out of office.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have to have a realistic sense of what powers are actually at their disposal. So, they could impeach Donald Trump, they could impeach Alex Acosta, but Mitch McConnell, like in order to remove either of them from office via impeachment, 20 Republican senators would have to vote to remove them from office. And, Donald Trump could eat a live baby on national television,
yep.
and there wouldn't be 20 senators.
Right. I agree.
Who would vote to?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I think House Democrats could be doing more. I think they could have more inquiries. They could have more hearings. They should be doing that. They should do everything that they can in order to bring the monstrousness of this administration to people's eyes. But I also think that we have to understand that the way that Donald Trump will be removed from office, if at all, is through an election.
Sure.
It's not going to be through impeachment and conviction because he has the Senate in his back pocket.
I agree, for what it's worth. I agree that he will not be convicted in the Senate. But I think the American people need to hear how he's broken so many laws, how he's really, taken this country to the verge of insolvency and taken the world to the brink of war and destruction. And many of his followers don't know that he's done anything wrong because all they do is watch Fox so-called news, who doesn't tell them he's done anything wrong. Again, I believe the polls are showing a higher percentage of people wanting to see Trump, at least an impeachment inquiry begun, than wanted to see Nixon impeached back in the 70s. I think the numbers are more in favor of Trump being impeached at this point. The tides didn't turn on Nixon until they started the televised hearings.
Right. Yeah, no, I certainly think there should be more hearings. There should be more inquiries. Some of the issue there is that, one thing I'm watching very closely, I'll probably attend the argument, is on Friday, there's a case at a court of appeals here in D.C. about whether or not Trump can prevent his accounting firm from turning over a bunch of his financial records. So, Democrats have been thwarted and their ability to engage in those kind of inquiries because of the massive resistance that this administration is showing to any kind of subpoena. And so the way that normally is dealt with is you get a court order saying, no, you can't resist that subpoena. You have to comply. And this case is the first in line where I think we're likely to get get the courts to say, no, you can't resist that subpoena. And if that case goes against Trump, I think you could see the dam start to break.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question is whether or not this Supreme Court will play games and try to save Trump. But if they get that court order, and they should get that court order, the Trump's arguments are very weak. That strengthens the Democrats' hands, I don't think there's much point in holding a hearing if you don't have evidence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's much point in conducting an inquiry. What we are after is evidence. And what we want House Democrats to get is evidence. And if this court hearing goes well, then all of a sudden they start to price a lot of things open where they can start to get a lot more evidence.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess all bets are off. We just have to wait and see. But I hope that the Democrats grow a pair and actually do something rather than just write sternly worded letters, because that seems to be where we're at these days.
Yeah. No, they should use every power at their disposal.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully what we're going to find out in this court hearing on Friday is that they will have the powers that should be at their disposal. And they would be foolish not to use it to its utmost.
Absolutely. Ian Millhiser, again, find him at thinkprogress.org, where he does great work, and pick up the book Injustices, because I think the Supreme Court is something we're going to be watching for very closely for the next at least year and a half anyway, hoping that Ruth Bader Ginsburg stays very healthy. Ian Millhiser, thank you so much. It's always great to hear from you, and I appreciate your input.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. So that's it. There's more that I could have asked him. I could have asked him about the whole census question, where a judge told Trump, sorry, you can't switch out all the lawyers. They tried to switch out the Department of Justice lawyers that had been working on this citizenship question for the census. Some reports say that none of the lawyers want to go ahead with this folly of a challenge. As it was, Wilbur Ross had already said, no, I will, we'll do the census without the question. And it was Trump who tweeted out of the blue, no, we're not done fighting yet. And a judge yesterday said, you know, regarding your request to switch out all of the lawyers, no. They can still bring in new lawyers. Nothing prevents that. But the judge is not letting the lawyers that have been working on the case thus far out. So there's that. All right. We are going to move on. I told you it's a busy day today. Let me explain to you the genesis of our next guest as I attempt to dial while I'm speaking. This is always dangerous. So I'm on an email list with a lot of very, very smart people. And somebody on the list, oh, actually, the guy who runs the list, wrote a post about a new, I think it's a new organization, an organization dedicated to progressive foreign policy. Here we are in an election season. It's not an election year yet. But, you know, one thing we don't really know so much about is where the Democratic candidates stand on foreign policy. I mean, I pretty much know where Bernie Sanders is. We know where Tulsi Gabbard is. I think we know where Elizabeth Warren is, but the rest of them, not so much. And so there's a new piece, I think, a new organization called the Quincy Institute, which I believe is named after John Quincy Adams, but I could be wrong. There was a big article about it in the Boston Globe last week. And this is a group that is going to be doing progressive outreach, and I guess lobbying on foreign policy. Well, another member of the list said, you know, it's great. The Quincy Institute is awesome, but, you know, we've been here for a while now and we're doing amazing work and we are a partner of the Quincy Institute, but I want to make sure you know that there are some of us doing the hard work on these issues every damn day already. And I thought, you know, that's a really good point. And because of that, I thought we should invite Stephen Miles onto the show. So Stephen Miles is executive director of Win Without War. They're at winwithoutwar.org. Hey, Stephen, you there?
I am. How you doing, Nicole?
I'm doing okay. Sorry, it's been just a crazy morning. I was watching the Acosta hearing and then, you know, everything else that's going on is just nuts. It's, you know, Donald Trump said one thing.
What a time to be alive.
No kidding. He said one thing that I agreed with in the campaign, something about, you know, there's going to be so much. I'll make your head spin. He's making our head spin. All right. It's just insane. But I wanted to talk with you because of the email you wrote to the list to find out not only what Win Without War is doing, but what other organizations are doing. We know that we are involved, although we're not technically involved in a war in Yemen, we are. We're involved in Syria. We're still in Iraq. We're still in Afghanistan. And we're engaged in I believe, some form of combat in other places around the world, too. It's not just limited to those four, is it?
No, it's not. You know, we've seen time and time again over the last several years that the U.S. is, by any stretch of the imagination, at war in a number of places far across the globe, whether that was the troops who lost their lives in Niger, whether that's the, you know, continued military action of the United States in places like Somalia. We talked about Yemen, where United States-made planes are being flown by U.S.-trained pilots, dropping U.S.-made bombs. It's hard to call that not a U.S.-involved war. And of course, you're right. We have thousands of troops on the ground in places like Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And so, you know, we continue to have not just a large global military presence, but a global military presence that's largely engaged in a series of endless wars.
Right. And so, but, and if you hear Trump talk about it, he's, you know, I don't believe anything he says, so it's, I shouldn't waste the breath on saying what he said. But, you know, we had a kind of a close call just last week or the week before. Of course, he plays these games with foreign nuclear powers, and he's been fucking with Iran of late. There was an issue where a tanker was attacked in the Straits of Hormuz, the Trump administration is saying Iran did it. They're saber rattling. We don't know. I mean, from the video they released, do we know that Iran planted explosive devices on these tankers, or is Trump just ratcheting up the rhetoric here?
Well, the situation in the Persian Gulf is incredibly fraught. And I think, you know, you mentioned the attacks that we saw on oil tankers there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we had the incident that sparked the near use of U.S. military force was the downing of a U.S. drone. Iran says over their airspace. The U.S. military says it was in international airspace. There's no question there that it was a United States drone and that the Iranians shot it down, just a question of where it was located. But all of this really comes back to a situation in which we've seen the Trump administration take step after step to ratchet up the pressure, to walk away from the historic diplomatic agreement, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran deal, the Obama-era agreement made between Iran and the international community. It really put its nuclear program under a lock and key, locked it up in a box, and had calmed tensions in the region in a really significant way. We saw Trump walk away from all of that, put us on a collision course towards war. And so we're now seeing these kinds of incidents, sometimes questionable who did them, sometimes not. But what's clear is that we're in the inevitable cycle of escalation that his administration put into motion. And it gets back to something you said. Look, candidate Trump was very clear. The U.S. shouldn't be in stupid wars. Mm-hmm. He ran on a dovish platform compared to Hillary Clinton. And just like Barack Obama before him, the candidate who was calling for the U.S. to get out of international wars, to be involved in less overseas military misadventures, that candidate won because that is a majority, overwhelmingly popular position in this country. The problem is once people get into office, they tend to do different things. And so we've seen in the case of Trump a significant ratcheting up to the use of military force, a removal of some of the constraints that had protected civilians, getting in bed with horrific folks like the Saudi regime and the UAE who were committing mass war crimes and causing gross human rights abuses in places like Yemen. And of course, as we talked about just now, putting us on a collision course towards conflict with Iran. You know, he likes to get out there and talk about kind of, he's a deal maker, he's a negotiator. He likes that he has this line about that if it wasn't for him, we'd be in a war in North Korea.
Yep.
You know, it's just preposterous, right? The reason we were on the brink of war with North Korea was exactly like Iran. He ratcheted up the pressure. He got into a name-calling contest with the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. He was talking about fire and fury and button measuring contests and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, they were able to de-escalate by simply no longer being a petulant child and name-calling and threatening nuclear annihilation. That's not like a great step for diplomacy and peace. It's simply no longer banging the drums of war. But that's what we get with this president. You know,
right.
You alluded to that earlier.
Right.
We shouldn't be surprised.
And we get somebody who manufactures these crises. First of all, he pulled
Absolutely.
Us out of the Iran the nuclear deal with Iran, which was working. They weren't enriching more uranium. They weren't developing a nuclear weapon. They were working at least it was working for the time being. Anyway, and he pulled us out of that, and then he ratcheted up tensions, and I guess, you know, was planning for a strike, and then at the last minute he called it off and tried to present himself as the hero for not striking at Iran. The whole thing smacks of bullshit. It's all bullshit, I don't know what the purpose of it is to entertain his feeble mind, or I don't know, to make him feel like a manly man or something. But obviously, this is no way to conduct foreign policy. So that brings us, Stephen Miles, to Win Without War. So when you go to the website, winwithoutwar.org, you're greeted with a statement: let's build a movement for progressive foreign policy. We're building a better U.S. foreign policy that favors peace, not militarism. Great goal. So tell us about Win Without War. How long have you been here and what do you do?
Sure. So When Without War actually owes its origins back to the run-up to the Iraq War in 2002. That's what the name is a reference to. And what it was at the time, a number of progressive organizations, national organizations who worked on all sorts of different issues, came together. They recognized the path that George Bush at the time was putting us on towards going to war with Iraq. They wanted to do what they could working together to try to prevent that war. And obviously the die was cast by that point. But then they continued to work together and continued to advocate and push and campaign for ending that war. And then gradually they expanded in kind of the underlying policies that led to that war, right? They realized and they recognized that it wasn't just enough to oppose the Iraq war, that there was a sickness in American foreign policy that led us to that war, mm-hmm. and that we had to start to deal with those problems. And that really is when Win Without War becomes what it is today, which is kind of, you know, the nation's leading progressive campaigning organization focused on not just kind of ending these overseas endless wars, but really getting at the militarism that's the rot at the core of U.S. foreign policy, putting forward a more progressive vision of U.S. foreign policy, one that recognizes that we have to have 21st century security challenges to the kinds of threats we face today, things like climate change, things like gross income inequality and the rise of authoritarians around the world. You know, these are the real security threats we face, and we shouldn't be naive about them. But when we continue to simply throw hundreds of billions of dollars a year down the drain on weapons that were designed to fight wars from generations, you know, long since past, we're never going to get there. And so we have to have a whole different way forward.
Got to ask you about your thoughts on Trump's military salute to America on the 4th of July. the parading of military hardware of tanks and fighter jets through Washington, D.C., does that frighten you?
Oh, absolutely. Look, this was like authoritarian playbook 101.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen the president do this time and time again, and we can't take away the reality of understanding how we got here and who this is, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a president who himself said he avoided going to Vietnam because he didn't think it was worth dying in that war. He
right.
he mm-hmm. had multiple deferments for what by most accounts are non-existent bone spurs.
Right.
This is a president who has repeatedly disrespected and insulted men and women who have put the uniform on, and you know, whether or not those of us supported those wars or not, they put their lives on the line defending this nation. And time again, he's insulted those folks. He now wants to try to wrap himself in the flag of the U.S. military. He wants to surround himself with military hardware to look tough. He wants to talk about spending $750 billion on the military as if that somehow is in and of itself a policy. All of this clearly, by every measure, was about Donald Trump. Not about a salute to America like he claimed it was, not about any sort of reality check on the state of the United States military or the role they play in a free and fair society. You know, this was Donald Trump, the showman, once again being a showman.
Right.
And sure, you know, there was fireworks and tanks, and he was able to, you know, I just saw today the Trump Hotel in D.C. was sold out. The RNC was giving out VIP tickets right in the front.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of questions about this event and the corruption at it. You know, in the coming days, we'll be launching a campaign asking Congress to look into some of these. I live here in D.C. I'm a D.C. resident. My government is just saying now that their security fund is bankrupt
yep.
because of the cost of this. There's,
exactly.
there's a tremendous amount here to be answered for. And at the end of the day, at a time when there's so much division in our country, when there is so much problems and challenges we face, this was yet another opportunity squandered where we could have been coming together.
Mm-hmm.
We could have been having a conversation about what it means to be an American. What is the country that so many of us are proud to call home, that so many people want to come to and want to live to call home? What are we about? And instead, this president made it about celebrating himself.
Yeah, well, it's par for the course. So we're speaking with Stephen Miles. He's executive director of Win Without War. I'm cynical by nature, and living under this Trump regime has made me even more so. But I'm trying to be positive and think that in November of 2020, we will elect a good progressive Democrat who will help take us out of this horrific era in American life and turn things around. Has Win Without War done any kind of comparison or study on the 25 Democratic candidates and what their foreign policy plans are?
We certainly have done some analysis. You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Win Without War itself is a nonpartisan organization. We don't engage in electoral politics. We neither support or oppose any candidates.
Gotcha.
We certainly talk about the records of members of Congress and other elected officials and the kinds of things that they do. And certainly in a situation like this where we're having a national debate about the issues that we work on every day, we are, of course, engaging in that debate and looking to see what candidates are saying about issues we care about. And understanding some of the details of things that they care about. And, you know, one of the things I've been heartened by is that unlike 2016, where, truth be told, we had an entire Democratic primary in which foreign policy was never talked about.
Right.
You know, not only is this a huge area of you know, this is literally the entire rest of the world. It's actually the one thing that the president probably has more control over than everything else in their purview. And so it's really a detriment when we don't hear from the men and women who want to be the commander in chief, who want to be president of the United States, when we don't get to hear from them about what they want to do, what their worldview is, what do they think America's role in the world is. So I will say we've been heartened that in 2020, we've begun to have that debate. You know, we've already had a number of foreign policy speeches by major candidates. Senator Sanders has given two such speeches. Senator Warren has given one. Mayor Buttigieg gave one recently. And tomorrow, Vice President Biden is going to be giving one as well. And so we're beginning to get that conversation that's so important that we were denied 4 years ago, or I guess 3 years ago.
Right. And hopefully, look, I'm all for more voices, but hopefully the field on the Democratic side will begin to narrow and the serious candidates can put their policy ideas forth so we can make an informed decision. I don't know about you, but the news that Tom Steyer was jumping into the race really pissed me off. Here's somebody who's going to spend $100 million of his own money, because he's got it, on a vanity project to run for president, when he could fund an entire progressive media network to help counter the Fox effect. There's so many things he could do with that money that to launch a presidential campaign, I just think is just horrible. But that said, there is one candidate who was declared, who didn't make it on the stage for the first debates, who I would love to hear on a national debate stage to talk about foreign policy, and that's Senator Mike Revelle, because he's probably the most anti-war of all the candidates. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, you know, Senator Gravelle has certainly made that a component of this campaign. We've also heard that from Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, who's been very outspoken on issues of war and peace in the past. But there's some interesting folks also in the mix. You know, Seth Moulton, who obviously, is, I think no one's going to argue he's the most progressive candidate in the race, but he is a four-time Iraq combat veteran and has an interesting position on some of these things. Admiral Sestak, you know, very late entry into the race.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much we'll be hearing about him, but you know, Joe Sestak is, at least when he was in Congress, and I believe it's still true, he is the highest ranking military official ever elected to Congress.
Wow.
You know, he is a man who has been very outspoken on issues of war and peace and has the credibility to back that up. I once had a conversation with him about what it was like when he was commanding ships in the Persian Gulf and dealing with the Iranians and threats in the region personally. And that has led him to be an outspoken proponent of not going to war with Iran in the past. And so I think if he gets on the debate stage, we'll certainly hear a lot about that. And as you mentioned, Mike Gravel, obviously also a military veteran and has been tremendously outspoken on these issues. Mayor Buttigieg, I should mention as well, is also a veteran and talks about that tremendously and has come out with some interesting positions and calling for, you know, ending our endless wars and some of these other positions. So I'm hoping that we'll get more than one question in some of these debates. It would be nice to have a fruitful conversation. And I think we hear some real progressive positions get put out there by some of the candidates.
Yeah, well, I hope they get a chance to air them, because I think the American people need to hear them. I know that Bernie Sanders, I think he's the one who introduced the resolution to get out of Yemen. I believe Elizabeth Warren has touched lightly on foreign policy, but not as much as I'd like to hear from her. These are things we need to hear more of, obviously. And I'm guessing Win Without War will help to corral those positions and at least give the information out.
Yes, absolutely. You mentioned our website, winwithoutwar.org. As the campaign goes on, we'll no doubt be talking about what the candidates said there. I also have written some analyses of the speeches I mentioned earlier that Senator Sanders and Senator Warren both gave. We'll likely be putting something out about Joe Biden's speech. And there's some other great organizations out there doing this. You know, there's an organization primarily veterans run called Common Defense. Mm-hmm. They have a pledge that they're asking candidates to take called pledging to end the forever war. And so far, you know, Bernie, Senator Warren, Senator Booker, Secretary Castro, Beto O'Rourke, Mike Gravel, and Andrew Yang have all pledged, signed that pledge that if they were president, they would end the forever war. And so, you know, we're seeing these things. They're getting out there. You know, one of the things we hear time and time again from members of Congress that we talk to is one of the reasons they don't talk about foreign policy is, you know, when they were on the campaign trail, nobody asked them about it.
Right.
You know, nobody said, hey, how are you going to get us out of Afghanistan? Hey, what are you doing about the situation in Yemen? You know, we worked as an organization to change that. We think that the foreign policy debate needs to be democratized. We work every day to bring Americans' voices into these conversations. But over the next several months, people are going to have a real chance to meet some of these candidates, particularly if they live in places like Iowa, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. Nevada, South Carolina. You know, they're going to get real face time.
Yeah.
And this is a real opportunity to ask these folks how they feel about these issues. You know, do they think it makes any sense that we have men and women in uniform today in Afghanistan risking their lives who were not even alive on September 11th?
Yeah.
I mean, that is remarkable.
It really is.
And if these guys want to be the next commander in chief and they want to be in charge of our country, they need to answer for what they're going to do about that situation.
Most definitely. Stephen Miles, I know you're getting ready to head to Philadelphia. Netroots Nation kicks off tomorrow. For many years, I would go and broadcast live from there. It's been about 5 years since I've been, for a number of reasons. But I see that you're participating in a few panels. You have one that you're hosting Saturday morning, dealing, obviously, with this issue. What's your panel about?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for bringing it up. You know, we're going to have two panels on Saturday, one at 9 in the morning, another one at 2:15 in the afternoon. The conversation in the morning is going to be about the issue you mentioned earlier, the fight in Congress about ending U.S. support for the war in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be talking with some of the amazing activists who were involved in that fight for the last several years. We're going to talk about how we went from being alone in the wilderness to actually winning, going up against some of the most well-funded special interests, some of the most powerful foreign governments, and in fact, the entire weight of the U.S. Kind of military establishment, and won that debate. We're going to talk about what that means and what that might do, what that might tell us about how we work on other foreign policy issues. And then this conversation we're having right now about 2020, that's going to be the focus of the panel at 2:15.
Oh, good.
It's going to be moderated by my colleague, Kate Kaiser, who's our policy director, going to feature Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and a number of other panelists talking about foreign policy in the 2020 elections.
Awesome. And I know Netroots Nation streams many of these panels. You can go to netrootsnation.org. And I know Free Speech TV is probably going to be carrying a lot of it. I know Tom Hartman's going to be broadcasting live from there as well. So I will not be there this year, but I'm sure, it's a progressive gathering. We'll be well represented. Stephen Miles, thank you so much. Thanks for the work you're doing and for reminding us of the work you're doing. It is an issue, the foreign policy, that, as you said, does not get covered enough. It wasn't mentioned enough in the one debate we've had so far, and I don't know that I can count on CNN to give it the exposure it needs. So hopefully, you know, as we get further into the campaign and the field narrows down a bit, I'm hoping we can check back in with you to find out really the you know, better position statements from the, you know, the final the top tier candidates anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be on any time. And thanks for doing all you're doing and having these important conversations.
My pleasure. Thank you. And have fun at Netroots. Say hi to everyone for me.
Thanks. Will do. We'll miss you in Philadelphia.
Okay. Have fun. Take care. Thanks so much, Stephen. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Stephen Miles, again, executive director of Win Without War. They are at winwithoutwar.org. You can find Stephen Miles on Twitter at SPMiles42 or Win Without War at Win Without War. It's an important topic. And again, we had this little discussion online, and I thought, you know, this is something we should talk about, because foreign policy has to be a consideration when you decide on your candidate. All right. So we had two guests today, a lot of stuff going on. There are a lot of stuff I didn't have time for. I didn't have time for our funny today. And you know what? Do we have time? Maybe I'll save that for tomorrow. Let me play one thing for you that popped up on my Twitter feed this morning and is so sickening. And I don't only like to share sickening things with you, but this is sufficiently sickening that I want to share it with you. So if you're watching on YouTube, you'll get the full effect because there is a clip from a Howard Stern show with, Donald and Ivanka in the studio. I don't know what year this is, but if you're just listening, listen carefully. You'll be able to hear it. It's a very quick clip. It runs 10 seconds. So know that the voices you'll hear, the main voice you'll hear is Howard Stern, and Donald Trump and Ivanka Trump are the two guests. They're sitting at a microphone. All right, so here we go. You are one. Okay, so that's the whole clip. You are one. And Donald shakes his head like, well, yeah. And Ivanka cracks up. It's like, yeah. You know, like this is something to be proud of. These are sick, sick people. Reprehensible. And if that's not bad enough for you, I have a clip that I saved from last week that I just haven't gotten to lately. So this is Donald Trump being asked a question by Peter Baker of the New York Times. I think you're smart enough to understand what's going on here.
Do you agree with him that Western-style liberalism, as it's been defined over the post-war period, is now obsolete and no longer relevant to today's world?
Well, again, he may feel that way. I mean, he sees what's going on, and I guess if you look at what's happening in Los Angeles, where it's so sad to look, and what's happening in San Francisco and a couple of other cities, which are run by an extraordinary group of liberal people. I don't know what they're thinking, but he does see things that are happening in the United States that would probably preclude him from saying how wonderful it is.
He does not understand what the phrase Western-style liberalism means. He thinks they're talking about liberal, like Democrats or progressives or liberal. That's not what they're talking about at all. He is just a dotard. He's an idiot. He's a moron. He has no business being in Washington, D.C., let alone in charge of it. I guess you, for some reason, YouTube didn't hear the clip of Trump basically admitting that, yes, he is a sexual predator. And Ivanka, you know, sort of, you know, glad-handing him. It's like, yeah, you are. Oh, my God, how funny is that? You're a sexual predator. Okay, and one last note, because I mentioned this briefly. It was sort of not the right place to mention it, but when I was talking to our guest, Stephen Miles, I mentioned about Tom Steyer jumping into the race. Once again, let me say this. Tom Steyer is already said he's going to spend $100 million of his own dollars to mount a run for the presidency, and he's asking for donations from average people like you and me to give him money to fund his run. Gag me. I'll talk more about it tomorrow. See you then, everyone.
You're listening to The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.